Well, as I was listening to that fulsome introduction, I wondered who she was talking about. It's really lovely to be with you and to be able to say a few words about the Rule of Benedict and a few words about the Benedictine life. And I've been encouraged to say a few words about myself, and I'm not sure those will be all that interesting. But I want to begin by simply saying, please do pick up your copy. This is the best and most responsible translation in English of the Rule of Benedict. It's a boiling down of this, which is a little bit thicker and bigger. And this RB, Rule of Benedict 1980, was written to celebrate the putative 1500th year celebration of the birth of Benedict. It was thought that perhaps he was born in 480. And it's, if you're serious about this, this is the one to get. It's got wonderful notes. It's a facing page Latin English. It's got every kind of index you could ever want, and the most wonderful introductions. But do take this with you, and as you read Judith Valente's charming and interesting introduction, keep this by you, because she's just giving you little bits. I was wondering how to begin this, and I think the first thing I want to say is that I've probably seen a lot of you before. I lived here from 79 to 90 and moved back in 2013. And Santa Barbara isn't exactly a small town, but it is a town that's small enough that people see each other, and then, you know, you go to a funeral, like John Stiver's funeral at Trinity on Saturday, and all of a sudden all these people you've seen, you have a connection to, so... And I like that, and that kind of connectedness is what I like, one of the things I like about history. Because we're connected in ways we don't know to many things and many people. And some of them are contemporary with us, and some of them are in the recent past, and some of them are long, long ago. And one of the beautiful things of studying history, and I'm sure many here will agree with that, is that we have a more complete and rounded sense of who we actually are. We like to think that the world is full of discovery, but it's also a kind of alien place. But in fact, everything is connected in one way or another. One of you with the beautiful gray hair, where are you, was talking to me before. Well, we'll leave it at that. At any rate, she was telling me how she was descended from some Viking. Yes, there you are. And I thought, well, yeah, probably. I've got a Danish pirate who used to be a white slaver in my background, and you never know. But this little document is, without question, after the Bible, the single most important piece of writing in Western history, because it was the foundation of Christian spirituality in the West for 1,500 years. And it is a foundation document of consensus/democratic government, which people don't realize. But, you know, consensus/democratic government is not practiced everywhere. And it's sometimes a little messy, as we're discovering this week. But and I do solicit your prayers for Mr. Trump and his family. They are, of all people involved in this, under the most stress. And whatever we think of people politically, they are people. But there are so many reasons to honor this document, and many of them are in Judith's book. And what I like about it, it's part of a genre. The first book in this genre was called Seeking God. It was by Esther DeWall. It came out in the late 70s. She's a good friend of mine and ours as a community. And it launched what I've come to call the Little Books on Benedict, which now has 20 or 30 at least representatives, and Judith is by no means the least of them. It's quite a good book, I think. And her take is that I want to discover in my own life as a not monk or nun, but as a serious practicing Christian, the value and validity of the rule of Benedict in her life. And I think it's a wonderful unfolding of that. Because actually everyone who enters the monastic life, that's what they're looking for. They just don't go off and work for the Wall Street Journal and insult random bus drivers along the way, which is her little story in chapter 7. We all have a different path, but everyone who gets involved in the monastic life does it ultimately for one purpose. And that purpose is to find God, or to be found by God, and then to live into God. And everyone's story is different, they're all conditioned by history and geography and culture, and by the individual vicissitudes of everyone's life. But her take on this I find very moving, because it's her story. I could tell my story, you can tell your story, but everyone has a story, and it's the story that's important. What is our story? What is the plot of our life? What have we chosen to be important in our life? How have we acted and reacted in our life? Who have we included in our life? Who have we excluded in our life? What have we discovered about ourselves along the way? One of the words in monastic spirituality is compunction. This is from the old spirituality, from which kind of died on the vine in the 1960s. But compunction is the discovery that you're not quite what you thought you were. One of the things that happens when you practice silence, and I use the word practice because we never of us, any of us, get proficient in it. We're always practicing, not just in the sense of putting into action, but actually just practicing. One of the things that happens is that things bubble up from the bottom of our lives. Things that we suppressed. We said something, we did something, we're not happy about it, so we just kind of move on, as they say. Or we gain an insight to something we did or said or something in the past, and we realize that it was much more important to someone else than perhaps to us, and perhaps there's something wrong in that. Compunction is the discovery of sin. Not sin as the naughty things that your mother didn't want you to do, which you shouldn't do, of course, and some of you are mothers, I suspect, so you know this. But and you're fortunate because you get it from both sides. You get it from your mother, and then you get to give it back. Sin is not just doing wrong things, correcting our behavior, curbing our tongue, and so forth. But it's also it's living in a complicated web of life in which we can hardly avoid hurting other people. Have you ever had the experience of having said something you thought was witty or harmless or whatever, and then discovering quite a long time later that actually that was a dagger that penetrated right into somebody's heart? Have you had that experience? You don't have to put your hand up. Well, that's compunction. And that is one of the things that monks cultivate. Monks try to create a lifestyle in which all of that becomes daily business. And so the rule of Benedict, it's a kind of manual of behavior. Actually, if you read through it, you'll notice that there are little gems along the way, which Judith and other people are diligent to pick out and hold up to us as spiritual wisdom. But most of it is about how you get through the day, what you do with your time. You know, the chapter 8 is about prayer, I believe. Well, it doesn't say what happens to you in prayer. It says how you can make prayer happen. You have to set down the times. You have to get somebody to ring the bell. You have to have the books set out. You have to have everybody show up. And you have to have some consequences if they don't. And that's 90% of his teaching on prayer. Ditto work. Ditto community life. Ditto this. It's about practicality. And in my experience, that's where the rubber hits the road. We can have all the silent moments we want and discover the warm feeling and praise God for that, and I've had it, and I hope you've had it, and it's what keeps us going through the rough parts. But actually, most of life isn't in the silent contemplation of the wonderfulness of God and His creation. Most of our life is in doing the things we have to do to make life happen. And in Benedict's era, that was different from our era. We don't actually have to go out in the fall and pick the crops. We might have to if we didn't have a lot of really, really, really underpaid people from south of the border. Then we might have to go down to Oxnard for a couple of weeks in the fall and pick the strawberries. Well, the monks sometimes did, and St. Benedict says, and the monks shouldn't complain if they have to go out and help bring in the harvest, because those are truly monks who earn their living by the work of their hands. This was not something they all wanted to hear, because many of them were from privileged families who had other people to do their work for them. Literally had other people in the sense of owned them. Many of them. So the Rule of Benedict is it's a text of its time. And that's interesting, but we want to have it as a text for our time. And so I think I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how we can do that. Because actually, everything we read is from another time. If you pick up the newspaper, it's about yesterday. Well, we used to pick up the newspaper. Now the thing costs, $1 a day to have your LA Times delivered, and it gets smaller and thinner and less interesting. I used to love it when they had sort of half-novel-length articles about subjects no one else in the world would write about: Latin America, the Pacific Rim, California. But no, it's owned in Chicago, or at least it was, and so all of that is gone. And it's not worth $1 a day. But at any rate, my point is, everything you read is about the past. Everything is about the past. That moment has gone. We're in this moment, and that was that moment. And so, in a very profound sense, we are always translating from the past into the present. And the question is, how do we do that? What are the tools we need to do that? And with the paper, it's easier because most of the people who are being written about yesterday are still around. But, you know, if you pick up a paper from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, how many people remember 50 years ago here? Several, I suspect. Who was the mayor of Santa Barbara 50 years ago? Who cares? I mean, it's terribly important to whoever is mayor now and to the people running our political operations, but really, who cares? And that's part of the problem of the past, because we forget. Things are forgotten. And we only have the equipment to deal with what we have the equipment to deal with. So we pick up these things and we find ourselves reading our own time back into a previous time. And assuming that because some kind and scholarly person has translated this for us, in, if it's a, in a foreign language, that we can understand it. This is one of the biggest problems in scriptural studies. Not at the academic level, but at the parish level, at the level that most of us are at. We think that because we have a book that we can open up and it's in English, that we can understand the text, but actually that's very difficult because the assumptions, the cultural assumptions, most of them, many of them, have changed. I could go on at length about this, but I'll give you one kind of brilliant example of that, and then we'll return to the rule of Benedict. You remember the story of the prodigal son. Anybody here does not know the story of the prodigal son? Good. That's a lovely story, isn't it? We all feel really sorry that the son does what he does, but we're all really glad when he comes back, aren't we? And we look at the father's generous welcome as he returns and we think, oh, how lovely, and then we see the kind of more than slightly acidic response of his elder brother. Well, you never killed a fatted calf from me and my friends, he says. And we look at that and we think, I'd never do that. So, but we react to that out of our own culture, which is a culture of infinite forgiveness for children, among other things. It's a culture of possibilities, infinite possibilities. If we only do the loving thing, everything else will turn out all right. But what we don't see in that, unless we've studied the past, is what's lying behind that in their culture. In their culture, their primary value is honor, not money or self development, which are the two great, you know, individual success. Those are the two great values of our culture, I think. For them, on the honor of your family is the most important thing. And what this child has done, of course, which we don't realize, is destroy the marriage prospects of his sisters, who aren't even mentioned, because he's taken half the money, and who's going to marry these girls if they don't have anything to bring to the marriage, has destroyed the retirement possibilities of his mother, whose husband will probably die before she does, if she's still around and survived pregnancies. So on that level, he's dishonored them. He's taken half of everything and wasted it away. Secondly, it's not as though he went off and tried to make a success of himself. He didn't even try. He just went off to the big city and spent it all. And what does that say about his parents? What does that say about his family? It says they didn't do a very good job with him, and so they're dishonored. his family has sunk to the bottom of their community as a result of this. And the father's job is to punish him, publicly admonish him, publicly make it clear that his family is not happy with this, and that his suggestion that he work for them for scraps is the appropriate response. And that would satisfy the cultural requirement. But of course the father doesn't do that. The father breaks the cultural expectation of everyone in their culture. He welcomes his child back and in effect goes meh to the dominant values of his culture. Now, it would be an interesting idea to what are the dominant values of our culture and how might we violate them? And then what do we do? You know, are we willing to do this to everyone's expectation of who we ought to be? Probably not. So that's just an example. This little document was revolutionary in its time, as was the New Testament, because it takes the values of the culture and turns them upside down. The values of the culture of the 6th century in Italy were the values of the late Roman Empire. It was a hierarchical society, the emperor at the top and the slaves at the bottom. It was understood to be run by a divinely or quasi-divinely ordained hierarchy of families. And the families were what they were. If your family were rich and powerful, you were going to be rich and powerful. If they weren't, they weren't. And everybody had their place. They were born into their place. And this book, The Rule, has as its primary principle, who do we respect in the community? They're not going to get rid of hierarchy. That's too deeply embedded in the heart and in the mind. But he says, we're going to have a very different hierarchy. Instead of the sons or daughters of noble families being revered, it's going to be the first one through the door. The first one through the door is the first in the line of precedence, the first of the line of honor, unless the abbot decides that for some good reason someone else should be raised up, but he never says that others should be depressed. Now, if you come from a society in which you're born into honor, that kind of turns it around, doesn't it? Because the guy that came from before you was probably a jerk. We don't stop being jerks just because we joined the monastery. As a matter of fact, we facilitate some kinds of jerkiness. And I could give you interesting but not kind examples of that. No, but he's saying, you know, the hierarchy of this world doesn't have any more secure foundation in reason than that does. It just happens to be what it is. And so it's a gospel sign that God can change the world. And he can change us. And so there's another set of values being propounded. Monastic life is, at this point in history, which we're talking about just for purposes of rough approximation, about the year 550. That's easy enough to remember. The monastic life has been chugging along for 200 years or more at that point. It begins in the deserts of Palestine, Syria, and Egypt in the late 200s, and it's already an ancient and fairly complex tradition. The scholarship in the role of Benedict for the last 20 or 30 years has been largely focused on how the role of Benedict reflects that tradition and all the different strands of it, the desert fathers and mothers, St. Augustine, who emphasizes community, St. Cassian, John Cassian, who takes the desert tradition and turns it into something that people who live in a cold and harsh climate can live. and incidentally puts it into Latin, which is what people could understand at that point. Those three strands and others. And in a way, what Benedict does in this wonderful, wonderful book, this is a kind of boiling down of 250 or more years of tradition, which is already venerable. And he's saying, this is a little book for beginners. A little book for beginners. He never pretends to be a spiritual master. He says at one point, do not strive to be called holy before you are holy. Do not strive to call yourself a dentist before you really are a dentist. Why? Because it'll get you into trouble. You really aren't quite there yet. And the irony of it is that you can be quite a competent dentist, and that's fine to hang out your shingle. But for the holiness part, you're never really quite there. And so there's a bit of kind of humor in that. He's saying, in effect, that you can't really get there. When, in fact, are we holy? Might be the question. And a few people might be narcissistic enough to say that, well, I think I'm there. But most of us have the good sense to realize that, well, not quite yet. And that's his point. That the monastic life is for the practice of holiness. It's for practicing at being holy. It's for practicing at prayer. It's for practicing at silence. It's for practicing at kindness to each other. It's for practicing at creating a community which is both effectively governed and consensually governed, and on and on. I think and this brings us to Judith's book, chapter 7 is about humility in her book. And incidentally, chapter 7 in the Role of Benedict is also humility. And the great image of humility in Benedict's rule in chapter 7 is the ladder of humility. Now, the ladder in the scriptural tradition is a hugely important symbol. Jacob's ladder, remember? Jacob rests, well, anyway, he sees the great ladder. And the angels going up and down. Jesus uses this image when he sees Nathanael, meets Nathanael, and Nathanael says, oh, you're this wonderful, wonderful person. And he says, well, yeah, I haven't seen anything yet. Wait, and you will see the Son of Man and the ladder with the angels going up and down. The ladder is that symbol of the downness and the upness of how do we get from the bottom to the top. And in Benedict's version of it, and I'm glad to see Judith Valente makes reference to the 12-step tradition, because there are 12 steps in Benedict's ladder. And the joke is, it's a ladder of humility. The higher you climb, the more humble you need to get. And you can never really, really achieve complete humility. You always have to go back down to the bottom and start over again. So, humility is the most important virtue in the monastic life, and it's a not inconsiderable virtue in real life. I think we all know people who embody humility in a wonderful and appropriate way, and how admirable that is. People who are never at a loss when they meet someone who is unknown to them, or someone who is less powerful than them, or someone who is poorer than them, who take the time to be interested in them and in fact are. And I think we've all met people like this and how gracious they are. And that is the virtue that is the foundation of the monastic life, because what we're doing is preparing to meet God. And Jesus tells us in so many ways that, you're really not probably going to realize that you've met God when you meet God. And he tells many stories about this and ends the 25th chapter of Matthew, which is the apocalyptic chapter, with the final story of the Last Judgment, and people are brought before the Lord, and he says, when I was naked and poor and hungry and sick and in prison, you helped me. And they say, well, when was that? And he said, well, whenever you did it to one of the least of these, you did it to me. And then he turns around and does the negative version of that. And that is of a piece with the teaching on angels, which the Old Testament is consistent about. The angels in the Old Testament, interestingly, are never initially seen to be angels, especially in the older parts of the Old Testament. They are always figures who appear to be human and enter into the situation, and something happens, something's said, something's done. And then they leave, and it's a little bit like the ending of The Lone Ranger. You know, repeat after me. Who was that masked man? In other words, you really ought to keep your humble, your humble being activated at all time, because you never know when God is with you. And that's of a piece with what I told you about compunction. You never know what you're saying. You never know who's listening. You never know who can benefit from your love or be hurt by your scorn. And so humility is that great virtue. And it in the 6th century and in most of human history, this is matched by behaviors, by kinds of walking, by kinds of looking, kinds of talking, which we find a little peculiar, until somebody crosses the invisible line that we've set up, and they're just a little too much, you know. And then we realize, aha, that's not so different. And the second thing she talks about is prayer. This is in chapter 8. I actually read it. And again, the prayer, we're used to thinking of prayer as, oh, sweet hour of prayer. You know, in the Protestant tradition, there used to be a hymn. I don't think it's sung very much anymore, and I won't sing it for you. But it, you know, the prayer is this kind of set apart time for God. And it, we do everything we can to make it lovely. And so our churches are lovely. We work very hard to make a sacred space. We work very hard to make a sacred time. We structure what we do in it. We have really quite elaborate conventions, all of which are to create a sort of separateness for prayer. And prayer is this moment when we kind of leave the rest of the world behind and open ourselves to God. And we need to do that, actually. And I hope we do it well. This church certainly does. I love their sanctuary. Of all the 60s type buildings I've been in, it's one of the loveliest. That's not much praise, I guess, but. But in the Benedictine tradition, prayer is not about so much about that special constructed hour. It happens all the time. You know, in the Benedictine tradition, it begins in the middle of the night, 2 or 2:30 in the morning. When I was younger, I used to think this was a terrible, unnatural thing. And now, getting up at 2 or 2:30 in the morning doesn't seem to be so unnatural. But that's the joke. None of you have that experience, I'm sure. So it follows nature. And that's about a 2-hour service. And there's a break. And there's another one before dawn. And there's another one at dawn. And another one at the 3rd hour and the 6th hour and the 9th hour. And then there's one at the end of the afternoon, and then there's one at the beginning of night. There are 8 times of prayer. And if you are in an observant Benedictine monastery that still does the 8 hours, you wonder how to get anything else done, which is a very good question, because you only have a couple of hours, 2-3 hours between each service, if that. And what is that about? Well, it's about breaking down the specialness of prayer. It's about making prayer and the rest of your life flow constantly back and forth, in and out of each other. So that time is structured by prayer. It isn't structured by work or by the alarm clock or by having to get the kids to school. I mean, those are all part of it, but it's structured by prayer. The second thing about Benedictine prayer is that it's really not about closing your eyes and having sweet thoughts, although we might do that. But it's not, in other words, about an emotional state. The prayer in the public prayer in Benedictine life is all laid out there. St. Benedict spends chapter after chapter after chapter telling you exactly which psalms and which antiphons to use at this service and that service, and then he changes them seasonally, and it's really very complicated. Because of that complication, we kind of miss the point. The point is that we're always going in and out of prayer. And it's not, as I say, an emotional experience primarily. It's all laid out. You know, you come and visit us, we only do it 3 or 4 times a day because, well, this is now, and that was then. And, you know, how many ways can we say, well, we really love the spiritual parts, but we really don't want to do it all. And monks aren't any different from that. But we also have to live in the time-governed world that we live in. But we're all over 70. 2 of us are over 80. 1 of us is over 90. Getting up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning isn't really in the program the way it used to be. So, but you go there and you'll discover that our prayer services are all laid out. They're all in a book. Every week I write a little guide telling you which item you should be on, and we follow that, and it's all written out. And it's, you know, my dear friend who's a Baptist pastor who helps organize the worship life at the rescue mission downtown finds that very strange. It's not personal. Well, that's the point. We are being given the Psalms, we're being given the Scriptures, and we listen to them, and we chant them, and they become part of us. And they become more important than we are. So, well, I promised you a few personal words. I was born into a clerical family. My father was an Episcopal priest. I was quite determined I wasn't going to do what he did. Because, well, you know, fathers and sons and all of that. We grew up in Las Vegas, and he started a church there. And I went off and did the thing that I thought was most different from that. I went to the greenest place I could find that would give me a scholarship, which was Michigan State University. And I got off the plane in Lansing. The first thing I thought was, who waters all this? It's all green. It's unnatural. and fell in love with medieval literature. Went to Cornell, did a doctorate in that subject, and ended up studying, in effect, monks. Because if you study early medieval literature, it's all remembered because of the monks, because they wrote it down. And most of it is written by them. And at a certain point, I decided I'd rather be one than write about them. So I found an order of Episcopal monks, the Order of the Holy Cross, and joined it in 1973. So, I would not say that the road has not been bumpy. I think anybody that's not had a bumpy life has kind of missed out. There used to be a convention of warriors showing their scars. I think there's something to that. And I've had my ups and downs too. And I think it is in those times of challenge, which we frequently fail. I mean, we'd like to tell the stories of our challenges as though we made the right decisions and it all was, you know, fine in the end. Well, often it isn't fine in the end, but here we still are. And what has God done with that? And so I don't want to tell you all my ups and downs. I just want to encourage you in yours. Monks and nuns do not escape that. We have our own kinds of ups and downs. And right now, we're going through one of those down times. You know, our community has decided we're going to close because there are only three of us, and three of us are over 70, and two of us are over 80, and one of us is over 90, and one of us is deaf, and one of us is kind of on the gentle downward slope mentally. And well, there it is. It's one of those times. Now, what can God bring out of those things? And I think the monastic life and the value of I think, Judith's book, the monastic life is a way of searching for a structure, a spiritual structure, that will help carry us through. It favors the old over the young. You know, it's wonderful when a church gets a young new minister, isn't it? In the Episcopal Church, they were all unmarried, and there used to be what was called the Parade of the Virgins when the new curate got there. And all the likely daughters were paraded out and brought to the church socials and introduced, and he was studied with care. and it's nice having young energy. And I think it's a shame that we all have to retire at 65 or 72 or whatever it is. Because I think some of us are just getting going at that point. Some of us have finally, you know, completed our 40th circuit around this particular track, and we think we know it. And maybe we have something to offer. I think monastic wisdom favors that kind of thing. It favors keeping at it. It favors realizing that if we're on a downward moment, well, yeah, we are. Try to find out what's Why are we on the downward moment? Was it our fault? Is there anything we can do about it? Is it just circumstance? How can we prudently address it? How can we live through it? And then when we've lived through it, what do we have to bring as a result of it? And I think that is a very monastic way of approaching this. I can't tell you the number of people we have in our community and other communities I know who have been up and down and up and down and up and down. And each time they come from down to up, they're a little bit wiser. And they're a little bit more worth listening to. Although the young people, of course, can't. You know, that's the pity of being young. But I think I can safely say that in this room. Where are the young people? Anybody here under 30? 40? Well, I won't go any farther. But I congratulate you for your efforts in reading this book. And I encourage you to begin reading whole chapters of this, because the picking out of the best bits is a good thing to get you going. But if you want to begin to ask the questions that open up, how are they different from us, as I tried to do with you with the prodigal son, then you kind of need to have the whole context. And ask yourselves, why didn't he want people to laugh? Well, things are just funny. What's wrong with that? But then watch British physical comedy on television sometime. They like laughing at people who are in pain. I think that's what he was getting at. And other things. I congratulate you for undertaking this study, and I hope you find in your own life's course things that are parallel to this. So, thank you.
Well, Adam, I was looking forward to this morning, and I know I said that he was going to put us right down in the middle of it, but you really managed it, Adam. Thank you so much. I can't wait for questions and answers at 11:30. But during this intermission, we're actually going to celebrate something that had some of its genesis here in this room last fall during the series called Listening with the Heart. You'll remember that we spent, 10 weeks learning the science, the theology, the practice of actually accessing and using the heart's knowing. And on October 11th last year, we had a pair of extraordinary young women who came to share with us their experience of learning to listen through the heart and finding themselves accessing dimensions of information and relationship and being that they could not have gotten to any other way at the most critical juncture in one of their lives. So I am going to introduce Catherine Weisenberger just for a moment to tell you about their book just out. It's called Beyond Ever After. She's brought Jocelyn with her, so here are our two authors just to say hello, and then we're going to, during our intermission, look at the books. They're on sale over there. There's a cake to celebrate with and pumpkin pie. So here are the authors of our launch.
Wonderful. Okay, well, we just, I've been part of the Word and Life community. I'm one of those obnoxious people that always ask a question. So, or they're not obnoxious, I'll say I am. So, anyway, it just felt right. We gave the talk here, and I just wanted to celebrate with you because many of you have been so supportive, and when's the book coming, and when's the book coming, and the book's here, and we brought some cake to celebrate, some pumpkin pie. I've got some bookmarkers. No need to get a book. Don't worry. There's no pressure. For the Word Life community, we're doing 25% off So, and if you don't have your purse or your wallet, you can sign up, and I'll bring you a book next week, and Jocelyn and I will sign them. And, you know, I think a lot of the concepts in this book are the concepts that we study here. You know, it's about community, it's about love, it's about faith. It's definitely about God and spirituality. And Jocelyn's husband, Kevin, who died from brain cancer, was a faithful man, carried his Bible with him every day. So, and you'll get to hear from him about his faith and what it means to him. And Jocelyn, who was a complete skeptic and angry that God was killing her husband, and maybe still a little angry, I don't know. But so anyway, and her developing a faith, which was what her husband wanted to leave her most when he left this world, was he wanted her to have the faith that he had. And I think he gave her that, and what a gift. So enjoy the pie, pumpkin pie, the cake. We'll be over there. And thank you so much for all your support. And for this community and what it gives me every time I walk in these doors. And thank you for your talk. And it's all enriching. So thank you. We'll be over there.